I thought of the story because when I'm at Holden, I'm so aware of my heritage as a Norwegian, and yet I'm a very urban person from the middle of Chicago, and I've been so enriched by 20 years of enjoying, loving, appreciating, getting to know other people's cultures and heritages. And we're going at Holden now into a couple of weeks of really pushing ourselves to get better at being multicultural, starting tomorrow, in fact, starting today. There's the first multicultural people are arriving now, and we're delighted that you're here. We're looking at ourselves, including tonight at the forum, in a kind of self-conscious way to think, why is it that Holden is so white most of the time? What is it about us that stops other people from coming here? So I thought it would be fun to look at the question of heritage through someone else's eyes than my own, but through Alice Walker's eyes, whom I identify with and I just love. I think she's such a wonderful writer. So I will read you the story, and then we'll talk about it. So is that a good plan? Can you live with that? Everyday Use by Alice Walker. I will wait for her in the yard that Maggie and I made so clean and wavy yesterday afternoon. A yard like this is more comfortable than most people know. It is not just a yard. It is like an extended living room. When the hard clay is swept clean as a floor, and the fine sand around the edges lined with tiny, irregular grooves, anyone can come and sit and look up into the elm tree and wait for the breezes that never come inside the house. Maggie will be nervous until after her sister goes. She will stand hopelessly in corners, homely and ashamed of the burn scars down her arms and legs, eyeing her sister with a mixture of envy and awe. She thinks her sister has held life always in the palm of one hand. That no is a word the world never learned to say to her. You've no doubt seen those TV shows where the child who has made it is confronted as a surprise by her own mother and father, tottering in weakly from backstage. A pleasant surprise, of course. What would they do if a parent and child came on the show only to curse out and insult each other? On TV, mother and child embrace and smile into each other's faces. Sometimes the mother and father weep. The child wraps them in her arms and leans across the table to tell how she would not have made it without their help. I have seen these programs. Sometimes I dream a dream in which Dee and I are suddenly brought together on a TV program of this sort. Out of a dark and soft-seated limousine, I am ushered into a bright room filled with many people. There I meet a smiling, gray, sporty man like Johnny Carson, who shakes my hand and tells me what a fine girl I have. Then we are on stage, and Dee is embracing me with tears in her eyes. She pins on my dress a large orchid, even though she has told me once that she thinks orchids are tacky flowers. In real life, I am a large, big-boned woman with rough, man-working hands. In the winter, I wear flannel nightgowns to bed and overalls during the day. I can kill and clean a hog as mercilessly as a man. My fat keeps me hot in zero weather. I can work outside all day, breaking ice to get water for washing. I can eat pork liver cooked over the open fire minutes after it comes steaming from the hog. One winter, I knocked a bull calf straight in the brain between the eyes with a sledgehammer and had the meat hung up to chill before nightfall. But of course, all this does not show on television. I am the way my daughter would want me to be. 100 pounds lighter, my skin like an uncooked barley pancake. My hair glistens in the hot, bright lights. Johnny Carson has much to do to keep up with my quick and witty tongue. But that is a mistake. I know even before I wake up. Who ever knew a Johnson with a quick tongue? Who can even imagine me looking a strange white man in the eye? It seems to me I have talked to them always with one foot raised in flight, with my head turned in whichever way is farthest from them. Dee, though, she would always look anyone in the eye. Hesitation was no part of her nature. How do I look, Mama? Maggie says, showing just enough of her thin body enveloped in pink skirt and red blouse for me to know she's there, almost hidden by the door. Come out into the yard, I say. Have you ever seen a lame animal, perhaps a dog, run over by some careless person rich enough to own a car, sidle up to someone who is ignorant enough to be kind to him? That is the way my Maggie walks. She has been like this, chin on chest, eyes on ground, feet in shuffle, ever since the fire that burned the other house to the ground. Dee is lighter than Maggie, with nicer hair and a fuller figure. She's a woman now, though sometimes I forget. How long ago was it that the other house burned? 10, 12 years? Sometimes I can still hear the flames and feel Maggie's arm sticking to me, her hair smoking and her dress falling off her in little black papery flakes. Her eyes seemed stretched open, blazed open by the flames reflected in them. And Dee, I see her standing off under the sweet gum tree she used to dig gum out of, a look of concentration on her face as she watched the last dingy gray board of the house fall in toward the red-hot brick chimney. Why don't you do a dance around the ashes, I'd wanted to ask her. She had hated the house that much. I used to think she hated Maggie, too. But that was before we raised the money, the church and me, to send her to Augusta to school. She used to read to us without pity, forcing words, lies, other folks' habits, whole lives upon us, too, sitting trapped and ignorant beneath her voice. She washed us in a river of make-believe, burned us with a lot of knowledge we didn't necessarily need to know, pressed us to her with the serious way she read, to shove us away at just the moment, like dimwits we seemed about to understand. Dee wanted nice things, a yellow organdy dress to wear to her graduation from high school, black pumps to match a green suit she'd made from an old suit somebody gave me. She was determined to stare down any disaster in her efforts. Her eyelids would not flicker for a minute at a time. Often I thought I fought off the temptation to shake her. At 16, she had a style of her own and knew what style was. I never had an education myself. After second grade, the school was closed down. Don't ask me why. In 1927, colored asked fewer questions than they do now. Sometimes Maggie reads to me. She stumbles along good-naturedly, but she can't see well. She knows she is not bright. Like good looks and money, quickness passed her by. She will marry John Thomas, who has mossy teeth and an earnest face. And then I'll be free to sit here and, I guess, just sing church songs to myself. Although I never was a good singer. Never could carry a tune. I was always better at a man's job. I used to love to milk till I was hooked in the side in 49. Cows are soothing and slow and don't bother you, unless you try to milk them the wrong way. I have deliberately turned my back on the house. It is three rooms, just like the one that burned, except the roof is tin. They don't make shingle roofs anymore. There are no real windows, just some holes cut in the sides, like the portholes in a ship, but not round and not square, with rawhide holding the shutters up on the outside. This house is in a pasture, too, like the other one. No doubt when Dee sees it, she will want to tear it down. She wrote me once that no matter where we, quote, chose to live, she will manage to come to see us, but she will never bring her friends. Maggie and I thought about this, and Maggie asked me, Mama, when did Dee have any friends? She had a few furtive boys in pink shirts hanging about on wash day after school, nervous girls who never laughed. Impressed with her, they worshipped the well-turned phrase, the cute shape, the scalding humor that erupted like bubbles in lye. She read to them. When she was courting Jimmy T, she didn't have much time to pay to us, but turned all her fault-finding power on him. He flew to marry a cheap girl from a family of ignorant, flashy people. She hardly had time to recompose herself. When she comes, I will meet. But there they are. Maggie attempts to make a dash for the house in her shuffling way, but I stay her with my hand. Come back here, I say, and she stops and tries to dig a well in the sand with her toe. It is hard to see them clearly through the strong sun, but even the first glimpse of leg out the car tells me it is Dee. Her feet were always neat-looking, as if God himself had shaped them with a certain style. From the other side of the car comes a short, stocky man, hair all over his head, a foot long, and hanging from his chin like a kinky mule tail. I hear Maggie suck in her breath. Is what it sounds like. Like when you see the wriggling end of a snake just in front of your foot on the road. Dee next. A dress down to the ground in this hot weather. A dress so loud it hurts my eyes. There are yellows and oranges enough to throw back the light of the sun. I feel my whole face warming from the heat waves it throws out. Earrings gold, too, and hanging down to her shoulders. Bracelets dangling and making noises when she moves her arm up to shake the folds of the dress out of her armpits. The dress is loose and flows, and as she walks closer, I like it. I hear Maggie go, again. It is her sister's hair. It stands straight up like the wool on a sheep. It is black as night, and around the edges are two long pigtails that rope about like small lizards disappearing behind her ears. Wa-su-zo-tien-no, she says. Coming on in that gliding way, the dress makes her move. The short, stocky fellow with the hair to his navels is all grinning, and he follows up with, Assalamualaikum, my mother and sister. He moves to hug Maggie, but she falls back, right up against the back of my chair. I feel her trembling there, and when I look up, I see the perspiration falling off her chin. Don't get up, says Dee. Since I am stout, it takes me something of a push. You can see me trying to move a second or two before I make it. She turns, showing white heels through her sandals, and goes back to the car. Out she peeks next, with a Polaroid. She stoops down quickly and lines up picture after picture of me sitting there in front of the house with Maggie cowering behind me. She never takes a shot without making sure the house is included. When a cow comes nibbling around the edge of the yard, she snaps it and me and Maggie and the house. Then she puts the Polaroid in the back seat of the car and comes up and kisses me on the forehead. Meanwhile, Assalamualaikum is going through the motions with Maggie's hand. Maggie's hand is limp as a fish and probably is cold despite the sweat, and she keeps trying to pull it back. It looks like Assalamualaikum wants to shake hands but wants to do it fancy. Or maybe he doesn't know how people shake hands. Anyhow, he soon gives up on Maggie. Well, I say, Dee. No, Mama, she says, not Dee. Wangaro Liwanika Kimanjo. What happened to Dee? I wanted to know. She's dead, Wangaro said. I couldn't bear it anymore, any longer being named after the people who oppress me. You know as well as me, you was named after your Aunt Dicey, I said. Dicey is my sister. She named Dee. We call her Big Dee after Dee was born. But who was she named after, asked Wangaro. I guess after Grandma Dee, I said. And who was she named after, asked Wangaro. Her mother, I said, and saw Wangaro was getting tired. That's about as far back as I can trace it, I said, though in fact I probably could have carried it back beyond the Civil War through the branches. Well, said Assalamualaikum, there you are. I hear Maggie say. There I was not, I said, before Dicey cropped up in our family, so why should I try to trace it back that far? He just stood there grinning, looking down on me like somebody inspecting a Model A car. Every once in a while, he and Wangaro sent eye signals over my head. How do you pronounce this name, I asked. You don't have to call me by it if you don't want to, said Wangaro. Why shouldn't I, said. If that's what you want us to call you, we'll call you. I know it might sound awkward at first, said Wangaro. I'll get used to it, I said. Ream it out again. Well, soon we got the name out of the way. Assal... Asalamalakim had a name twice as long and three times as hard. After I tripped over it two or three times, he told me just call him Hakim a barber. I wanted to ask him, was he a barber? But I didn't really think he was, so I didn't ask. You must belong to those beef cattle people down the road, I said. They say Asalamalakim when they meet you too, but they didn't shake hands. Always too busy, feeding the cattle, fixing the fences, putting up salt lick shelters, throwing down hay. When the white folks poisoned some of the herd, the men stayed up all night with rifles in their hands. I walked a mile and a half just to see the sight. Hakim, a barber, said, I accept some of their doctrines, but farming and raising cattle is not my style. They didn't tell me, and I didn't ask, whether Wangaroo, parenthesis D, had really gone and married him. We sat down to eat, and right away he said he didn't eat collards and pork, was unclean. Wangaroo, though, went on through the chitlins and cornbread, the greens and everything else. She talked a blue streak over the sweet potatoes. Everything delighted her, even the fact that we still used the benches her daddy made for the table when we couldn't afford to buy chairs. Oh, Mama, she cried, then turned to Hakim, a barber. I never knew how lovely these benches are. You can feel the rump prints, she said, running her hands underneath her and along the bench. Then she gave a sigh, and her hand closed over Grandma Dee's butter dish. That's it, she said. I knew there was something I wanted to ask you if I could have. She jumped up from the table and went over in the corner where the churn stood, the milk in it clabber by now. She looked at the churn and looked at it. This churn top is what I need, she said. Didn't Uncle Buddy whittle it out of a tree you all used to have? Yes, I said. Aha, she said happily, and I want the dasher, too. Uncle Buddy whittle that, too? Asked the barber. Dee, Wangaroo, looked up at me. Auntie's first husband whittled the dash, said Maggie, so low you almost couldn't hear her. His name was Henry, but they called him Stash. Maggie's brain is like an elephant's, Wangaroo said, laughing. I can use the churn top as a centerpiece for the alcove table, she said, sliding a plate over the churn. And I'll think of something artistic to do with the dasher. When she finished wrapping the dasher, the handle stuck out. I took it for a moment in my hands. You didn't even have to look close to see where the hands pushed the dasher up and down to make butter. Pushing the dasher up and down to make butter had left a kind of sink in the wood. In fact, there were a lot of small sinks. You could see where thumbs and fingers had sunk into the wood. It was beautiful, light yellow wood from a tree that grew in the yard where Big D and Stash had lived. After dinner, Dee, Wangaroo, went to the trunk at the foot of my bed and started rifling through it. Maggie hung back in the kitchen over the dishpan. Out came Wangaroo with two quilts. They had been pieced by Grandma Dee, and then Big Dee and me had hung them on the quilt frames on the front porch and quilted them. One was in the Lone Star pattern. The other was Walk Around the Mountain. In both of them were scraps of dresses Grandma Dee had worn 50 and more years ago, bits and pieces of Grandma Gerald's paisley shirts, and one teeny faded blue piece about the piece of a penny matchbook that was from Great Grandpa Ezra's uniform that he wore in the Civil War. Mama, Wangaroo said, sweet as a bird, can I have these old quilts? I heard something fall in the kitchen, and a minute later the kitchen door slammed. Why don't you take one or two of the others? I asked. These old things was just done by me and Big D from some tops your grandma pieced before she died. No, said Wangaroo, I don't want those. They are stitched around the borders by a machine. That'll make them last better, I said. That's not the point, said Wangaroo. These are all pieces of dresses Grandma used to wear. She did all this stitching by hand. Imagine! She held the quilt securely in her arms, stroking them. Some of the pieces, like those lavender ones, come from old clothes her mother handed down to her, I said, moving up to touch the quilts. Dee, Wangaroo, moved back just enough so that I couldn't reach the quilts. They already belonged to her. Imagine, she breathed again, clutching them closely to her bosom. The truth is, I said, I promised to give them quilts to Maggie when she marries John Thomas. She gasped like a bee had stung her. Maggie can't appreciate these quilts, she said. She'd probably be backward enough to put them to everyday use. I reckon she would, I said. God knows I've been saving them for long enough with nobody using them. I hope she will. I didn't want to bring up how I had offered Dee Wangaroo a quilt when she went away to college. Then she had told me they were old-fashioned, out of style. But they're priceless, she was saying now, furiously, for she has a temper. Maggie would put them on the bed, and in 5 years they'd be in rags, less than that. She can always make some more, I said. Maggie knows how to quilt. Dee Wangaroo looked at me with hatred. You just will not understand. The point is, these quilts. Well, I said, stumped, what would you do with them? Hang them, she said, as if that was the only thing you could do with quilts. Maggie was now standing in the door. I could almost hear the sound her feet made as they scraped over each other. She can have them, Mama, she said, like someone used to never winning anything or having anything reserved for her. I can remember Grandma Dee without the quilts. I looked at her hard. She had filled her bottom lip with checkerberry snuff, and it gave her face a kind of a dopey hangdog look. It was Grandma Dee and Big Dee who taught her how to quilt herself. She stood there with her scarred hands hidden in the folds of her skirt. She looked at her sister with something like fear, but she wasn't mad at her. This was Maggie's portion. This was the way she knew God to work. When I looked at her like that, something hit me in the top of my head and ran down to the soles of my feet. Just like when I'm in church and the Spirit of God touches me and I get happy and shout. I did something I had never done before. I hugged Maggie to me and then dragged her on into the room, snatched the quilts out of Miss Wangaroo's hands, and dumped them into Maggie's lap. Maggie just sat there on my bed with her mouth open. Take one or two of the others, I said to Dee. But she turned without a word and went on out to Hakim, a barber. You just don't understand, she said, as Maggie and I came out to the car. What don't I understand, I wanted to know. Your heritage, she said. And then she turned to Maggie, kissed her, and said, You ought to try to make something of yourself, too, Maggie. It's really a new day for us. But from the way you and Mama still live, you'd never know it. She put on some sunglasses that hit everything above the tip of her nose and her chin. Maggie smiled, maybe at the sunglasses, but a real smile, not scared. After we watched the car dust settle, I asked Maggie to bring me a dip of snuff. And then the two of us sat there just enjoying until it was time to go in the house and go to bed. So there you have it. Everyday use, it's called. What feeling does it give you at the end?
Warm.
Does it make anybody feel anxious? No anxiety surfaced? The conflict of a mother between her two daughters? Sorting it out? Any other feelings besides warm and lovely?
Sad.
Uh-huh. Why is that?
That there was so little understanding. That the mother kept trying to reach out and seems like there is a wall.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe a need for you to protect yourself against. It seemed like at some point she really wanted to move back into.
Can you think of a place in the story where you got that feeling?
She ate all the food.
Yes, yeah, that's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think of sharing food, she could have turned up her nose at that.
Uh-huh. And it was all the classic
yeah.
food.
I think they both loved the quilt their own way. They both had an attachment to it.
Mm-hmm. Can you say what? Why
one
you think?
One had one as more of an idol, you know, something they looked to put up, and then the other one had it more of something that they cuddled and hugged.
What would you have done with those quilts? Do you have quilts in your families?
I have a quilt my aunt made, and it's on my wall.
Mm-hmm.
And it was given to me as a wedding gift. My aunt was retarded, and I look at the work and how detailed and how difficult it was. And we used it, and the kids started spilling things on it,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to preserve it, so I hung it on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
But I think of Dee as going into a society where we have such a throwaway society, and we are trying to preserve. We see things being tossed away, and now people want to go back and preserve something because they see all of it disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
And she's kind of grabbed, it seems to me she's grabbed on to that, what other people are trying to grab and hold on to something that was the past.
And yet she had no respect for it whatsoever.
No.
And she takes things that she thinks are would be posh, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Because mm-hmm. it's good to have those kind of folksy things as long as you put it in your own environment. But when she goes to the environment itself, she has no respect for it.
What about the butter churn? The same.
Mm-hmm. But they're still used.
The butter churn had clabber in it. They were using it to make butter.
Yeah.
They were in the middle of making butter. And
if she were my daughter, I'd have said, forget it. I'm still using it.
Yeah. Can you mm-hmm. beat that? Someone coming into your home and taking one of the things that you use every day and saying it's charming and antique and she's going to put it on the...
Make it artsy. Yeah.
Something in her alcove, you know. The, but the mother didn't object at that point. She just let it go, even though she used that and needed it. But she did object when it came to the quilts, and they were the handmade quilts that were made out of the, you know, if you see fabric from a skirt you wore when you were a kid, or...
Memories,
yeah, all the memories. And the great-great-grandfather's little piece of fabric from his uniform from the Civil War. So those were the quilts where she drew the line. And it was tough for her to draw that line, I think. And she didn't draw it right away.
Could it have been pride that she had come from this, for Dee, that she had come from this and made, quote, made something of herself? Like I could see guests coming and her saying, "This is the way my family made butter or whatever." I don't know. Just a thought.
Yeah, like the Polaroid. Why did she get out that Polaroid and take those pictures?
I can see someone when they're with their parents. Some kids are really kind of snotty, but you know, when they're away from their parents, they really appreciate it. I don't know if she just. So it's just because she was around her mom that she acted that way, but maybe she did appreciate it in her own way.
The narrator here is the mom.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get a feeling that mom disliked or hated or felt bad about either of her daughters? What? Let's talk about how the mom felt about the kids. First of all, the one who stayed home, who had been injured mm-hmm. in the fire, Maggie, What kind of relationship did that, was that mother-daughter relationship, would you say?
It seemed to be real companions in a way like that. And she seemed quite protective.
Protective and caring. Tried to justify her place in life.
Mm-hmm.
And I got pity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did too.
From the mother.
Yeah.
I think she pitied her so much that she didn't recognize what her real needs were. It was more in pity. So that she didn't even see her as the adult. She was still her child. Mm-hmm. And because one child was more aggressive about what, maybe she always felt that was not where she should have been. A lot of children feel that I should have been born in this family, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, their ideas are counter to everything else the family sort of stands for, where they are and whatever their station in life is. And still searching, and at the time, and she's making attempts at having some remnants of what that past life is, but not knowing what the direction for it is. I mean, you know, we want our mother's ring or my dad's watch. Well, this book represented that sort of thing to have. And then years pass, and suddenly you look back and you've got all these things, and you realize why you always wanted it. You couldn't answer that question because you didn't feel that you were in the realm of the family or you were above where they were, but usually not necessarily feeling superior, just simply feeling outside of that family unit in terms of your own direction and what you want to do. You know, it's like the kid who wants to be an actress no matter what anybody says. You know in your head you're going to be an actress. If you tell anybody in the family, they're going to laugh at you. So it takes a lot of years of keeping your feelings to yourself. And sometimes you're perceived and your response is a very selfish, dogmatic way of taking from the family unit.
Do you think that the mom wanted Dee to change, to go away, to become all she could become in a different world?
Maybe she did and she didn't. You know, her the way she was raised in the family suggested that I want a better life for my child. On the other hand, having that better life, at what expense to us? The same as she did with the other daughter at the end when she discovered this child was truly selfish. And this child has sacrificed, and I don't have to pity her because she sacrificed, but because she truly deserves this, no more, no less. And it's also bringing about a difference in relationship.
Yeah.
Maturing in the relationship.
Yeah, I got that feeling too. First, when she talked about Maggie going away and getting married to John Thomas, it was just that then she would sit and Maggie would be off her hands. Mm-hmm. But then we learned that Maggie's got a mind like an elephant.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
Never forgets.
So she's not so dumb after all, is she? She remembers all the family history. She knows what the nickname of her great uncle was. And she. We also learned that she knows how to quilt. Mm-hmm. She did all that quilting. Mm-hmm. She has skills. She can do things. She's becoming a stronger person, but she really became a stronger person in this story. The maturing of a relationship happened, as you said. So that she could look people in the eye, she could be more comfortable with herself. But it took her mother standing up for her at that point to do that, and for her mother to respect her and the promise she'd made to her. What do we know about Dee Wangaroo? Why did she go to college? Remember that? We talked about how much she hated that house that burned down. And that was cold. I mean, she was relishing the burning of the house when her sister was burned. Seriously, that was cold, I thought. And that's kind of set the stage for us not to have much sympathy. Also the fact that the insiders in the point of view of the story were Maggie and the mother waiting for Dee to come, you know, sort of from the outside, and with all that anxiety and how upset Maggie was that her sister was coming. And right at the beginning we're told that her sister won't calm down Maggie will be nervous until after her sister goes. She will stand hopelessly in corners, homely and ashamed of the burn scars down her arms and legs, eyeing her sister with a mixture of envy and awe. So she does set the stage. Alice Walker sets the stage for us to be not very fond of the visiting sister. But I think she really works on that through the story and mitigates it and balances it off. She says, I used to think she hated Maggie, too, that she used to, mother used to think that one sister, the D, hated Maggie. But that was before we raised the money, the church and me, to send her to Augusta to school. So the mother was in charge of raising the money to get her to go off to college with the church. And then she talks about the reading, and she talks about D using reading almost as a weapon against them. But as many of you know, as a child who loves to read, I mean, you know children who are like that, who are just obsessed with learning. And it's a wonderful thing in a child. I mean, it also is oppressive. You know, they walk across the street reading books and cars come and they are rude to people because they're in a book. And, you know, they insist that you listen to the narration of the story in the book. You know, I mean, you know kids like that. But it's a gift. It's a fabulous thing in a kid. And she sounds like she read well. She read to us without pity, forcing words, lies, other folks' habits, whole lives upon us too, sitting trapped and ignorant underneath her voice. She washed us in a river of make-believe, burned us with a lot of knowledge we didn't necessarily need to know. Pressed us to her with the serious way she read, to shove us away at just the moment, like dimwits we seemed about to understand. So some of this is the mother's problem. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily, I mean, I think Alice Walker is gradually going to bring us to see that Dee has got a real legitimate place in the world, too. Mm-hmm. That it's not that one is bad and one is good. It isn't nearly that simple.
Go ahead. I was going to say, it's also that she's more advanced than her family, which also has set her apart, and it's the lack of understanding of that advancement that she has, and without them fully understanding the progression of her advancement, that has divided them. And at the end, the mother doesn't fully understand how intelligent her daughter is. She has a sense of she's very bright, but the full extent or impact of what that means is not impressive to her. Mm-hmm. But now she's into a stage of balancing the gifts of her child, which makes neither better than the other. Mm-hmm. They're just both what they are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good. I think that makes sense. What did you want
to say? Well, I felt Dee had a claim to have an opportunity for the quilt, or a quilt. You know, there's a sense, I'm a parent too, and if both my kids wanted this quilt, mm-hmm. it would be very difficult to make a decision. I think both had a right to claiming a quilt. And I think that Dee happened just to have an opportunity that Maggie didn't because of being able to go to school. But that choice was made by the mother.
Well, it was.
I don't see Dee as the bad side of Dee that I guess other people feel in here.
No. Well, let's look some more at Dee and find out more about her. I think that certainly Alice Walker starts by giving us on a platter mm-hmm. that Dee is going to be the mean one.
Yeah. But maybe not mean in the sense of evil.
I thought she was evil in that fire scene.
The fire thing, mm-hmm. the way it was described.
As a child. Although there are some fun things about her being a child, too, that her thing about style, that I love mm-hmm. this mother. She's got such an interesting mind. But she says, that even knowing what style is, you know, that she's got a lot of style. And yeah. And then another thing she says about Dee is, Dee, though, she would always look anyone in the eye, Hesitation was no part of her nature. Now, that's not bad.
No.
That's what you want, isn't it, with your kids? You want them. I mean, I say to my children at the end of every birthday party, go up to the parents and look them straight in the eye and say, thank you. You know? And my kids obediently go up and look them straight in the eye and say, thank you. You know, but you want your kid to feel kind of... but then Maggie being described as a lame animal that's been run over, and this picture of her in her pink skirt and red blouse behind the door so that you can only just see her. Do I look okay, Mama? But she doesn't even stand out where her mother can look at her. Your heart breaks for her, you know. She's a child that you want to nurture until she can look everyone in the eye. You know, you want that for her.
I wonder if the mother identified more with Maggie, as that this was a way that their lives have been, and Dee is something that she's never experienced.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
And the mother never finished school.
Right. She
But I think she was envious of Dee in some ways, too. Mm-hmm. She maybe identified more with Maggie, but she had perhaps more respect for Dee in some ways, except not in the way that she was cold. Towards their traditions.
It's interesting that the mother has dreams about how Dee would like her to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on Johnny Carson.
Scare her son too, though.
She'd like her 100 pounds lighter.
Right.
Mm-hmm. She'd like her skin lighter. Mm-hmm. She'd like her. You know.
Witty.
Mm-hmm. But what Johnson ever had a fast wit? How many Johnsons are in this room?
Well, she's probably being as human as the rest of us. You want to be something you're not.
Mm-hmm. Well, then that is such an interesting theme running through this story. Mm-hmm. What does the mother say she's good at?
Man's work.
Twice. She puts herself down a lot.
Mm-hmm. Puts herself down a lot, but she also says she's good at man's work. I mean, she brags on about her.
But when she describes the men, both the man that Maggie is going to marry and these men, it's very derogatory. That's what I got anyway.
Yeah.
Moss teeth.
Yeah. Made me wish she wouldn't marry him.
Yeah.
Or at the very least that he would buy and get a toothbrush. Yeah. And then the other guy with the goat tail beard,
yeah.
Which sounded just...
Hair down.
Yeah. And heavy and short. So being a man isn't... I mean, the two specific men we have described for us here, mm-hmm. are not men that one would want to be with. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, when the mother refers to herself as being like a man or being able to do a man's work, she likes those attributes in herself.
But it's also, she's a victim of the time. Mm-hmm. The parallel is when we say, I'm just a housewife. Is just a housewife negative because that's what you do, or is it negative because society has basically looked with disdain on housewives, and yet what you do as a housewife will exceed what your husband would do in an office in terms of the breadth of everything that has to be done. As she killed hogs and so forth, it was not because, quote, because she was doing man's work. It was because she was the one that was there and it had to be done.
She was the grown-up and that was their life.
Mm-hmm. No, that probably was no one.
She never talked about husband or father before.
Yeah.
And that leads me to believe that there probably wasn't one.
Right. No, I think it's pretty clear that there wasn't one.
Yeah. So it's pretty obvious that her view toward men is based on probably a relationship that she had previous, which... Men are all lost teeth, too.
She might have liked him, and he might have died, or who knows? I mean, it doesn't say. Just he's absolutely absent.
Yeah. Well, the absolute absence, so I mean, there's not even a recollection. It's like nothing.
And he wasn't part of that fire scene either, it sounded like.
Nothing.
Which had been 10 or 12 years before.
But it sounds more like her exposure, whether he had ever been there or not. It was her, the
narrowness of her exposure that would cause her, because there must have been a father when she came at some point, whether he was central or integral in her life, he was there at some point. And these children or daughters did not happen by accident, but I'm saying that evidently there was no centralness to the male figure, which would make her view other males when her daughter was daughters were concerned in kind of a distorted way, and that's what it kind of comes off as, more distorted rather than out of a real knowledge of perception when she says they're flashy dressers, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what are you really describing? Is the real metal of a person by the way they're dressed, or what comes from their heart or their minds, or a combination of all of those things?
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't address that part of it. And yet, her daughter's education supports the foundation for it, on the one hand, with D. On the other hand, her other daughter is kind of caught in the same time warp that she has, so there's still no alluding to the same thing. If Maggie were to describe the family process, she would probably describe it in similar terms as the mother, you know, without the real vision or without the clear vision of the man in any of their lives.
Be interesting to see what happens to Maggie if she marries John Thomas and goes on with what role she plays in that family and what role John Thomas plays. It seemed to me that this mother is an example of something that happens to all of us when we're used to dividing work in a balanced kind of way, or even unbalanced, and then the person we're dividing our work with isn't there, that somehow you assume their role. You move over some, you combine what you do with what someone else does and become all of it. You have to do it all, and you do it all. You know, and that there's some sense in which if you're super competent in a family in a certain area, everyone else in the family can be incompetent in that area. I mean, it can be as simple as how to clean a toilet, or it can be dealing with all the emotions in the family. You know, if there's one expert, then everyone else can kind of back off and let that roll. But here, this woman had to be everything. So she was everything.
One positive with Dee is she brought this man back.
Yeah.
You know, she brought him to her family, and it seemed to me that he was trying to be friendly in his own way.
Oh, I think he was.
An interesting thing that kind of struck me was when Dee, who used to be ashamed and wouldn't bring her friends to the house,
mm-hmm.
now comes with a Polaroid and, you know, the man. And all this sort of stuff. And I think sometimes it happens to any of us as we grow up that there are things that we thought were not so great when we were kids. You know, why fuss about this quilt? It's just an old quilt. But I think sometimes when we grow up, we see that little value, whether she did it in a pleasant way, which I don't think she really did.
And whether she's completely grown up.
Or whether she's completely grown up. But yet there was a little thing in there when she ate all the food,
mm-hmm.
and they were probably, it's probably not food that she would eat normally,
mm-hmm.
you know, in her life.
But she still had to change her weight.
Well, for now.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
you know, you know what it's like to have kids who are the teenagers and 20s, and, you know, people go through stages,
mm-hmm.
and they...
Mm-hmm.
Who knows where Dee ended up? But Dee did some things toward the end. Dee was generous in lots of ways. Maggie's brain is like an elephant's, and kissing people and wanting to give, even saying to her sister, you know, the world's different out there now. You could make something yourself. I mean, that's probably not appropriate to say to Maggie because of who Maggie is right now. But the impulse isn't a bad impulse. I think she doesn't have an evil nature or bad stuff about her family. And, you know, the boy that... She's strong. She's really a strong woman. And so when she was 16 and had that boyfriend that she was courting with, and she focused all of her attention on him, and the mother says, and he ran. He was quick to get out of there. He recognized when he was up against something that was too strong for him. He couldn't deal with it. But now this guy... who has an unfortunate beard, is probably good for her in lots of ways. So And he's at, and he's can take her, and he can come home with her, and he can handle her. So there's something there. The stuff about Maggie can't appreciate these quilts. She'd probably be backward enough to put them to everyday use. I mean, whenever you hear the line in a story that the author has chosen to make the title of the story, you know that that author thinks that's an important line. So so we have to look at that. And it's toward the end. It's in the, there are just a few paragraphs until the story ends when that line comes. Maggie can't, I'll back up a little bit. D. Wangaroot, and it's interesting to watch when the author chooses to use both names, mm-hmm. or when she uses D and when she uses Wangaroot, and then at
which
one
order?
Point, Miss Wangaroot. Mm-hmm. Just once she does that. Mm-hmm. But the use of names through it is important. D, parenthesis, Wangaroot, moved back just enough so that I couldn't reach the quilts. They already belonged to her. You know, she wouldn't even let her own mother, who'd made the quilts or been part of the maker of it, touch it for fear, whatever. I reckon she would, I said. God knows I've been saving them for long enough. Oh, no, I missed. Imagine, she breathed again, clutching them closely to her bosom. The truth is, I said, I promised to give them quilts to Maggie for when she marries John Thomas. She gasped like a bee had stung her. Maggie can't appreciate these quilts, she said. She'd probably be backward enough to put them to everyday use. So there you have the title and an insult, a gratuitous insult to Maggie. I mean, I'm using my grandmother's last quilt on the guest bed, and I'm starting to feel a little guilty about it, you know what I mean? I noticed there's a worn place on it now, and I'm thinking of taking it off the guest bed. But I've been putting it to not everyday use, but guest use, and I'm starting to feel kind of defensive about that. But this mother, very calmly, and maybe more so even than she feels, maybe to make her point, she's going a little farther than she would like to. I reckon she would, I said. God knows I've been saving them for long enough with nobody using them. I hope she will. I didn't want to bring up how I had offered Dee Wangaroot a quilt when she went away to college. Then she had told me they were old-fashioned, out of style.
But isn't Dee saying something else there? Isn't she also saying the typical sibling rivalry to prove your point that you deserve what you want?
Right.
You didn't insult your brother's sister as far as you did to get what you want. I mean, she's arrived at this point that she really feels that she deserves this now.
And if she gets them, they'll last forever.
Right, because she really, this is to bolster her argument. It doesn't matter if it's right or not.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, I think what it is, the mother suddenly sees through her daughters, both, for the first time with some clarity,
mm-hmm.
that, Maggie probably will use it. And that's probably what should have been happening with it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Because you didn't want it, I offered it to you. I mean, but what you've said sounded so good this time, suddenly it really makes sense to me. I understand why you said it.
Mm-hmm. I think there's some hurt feelings on the part of the mother, too.
Mm-hmm. But that's when you really get clear vision.
When your feelings are hurt. I tried to give these to you, and you wouldn't take it.
Yes.
So,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And she'd held on to that for a while, feeling.
Yeah. She did feel bad about it, I think. So,
then... mother wasn't using them. She was saving them.
She was saving them.
And so really, mm-hmm. he was closer to what her mother had been doing.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Putting them
treasures.
In the chest.
Mm-hmm. But the mother chose to help. The decision was made, my thinking, that who would it help most at this point to be the receiver in the quilts?
Mm-hmm.
Dee could handle the loss of them.
Dee didn't need help.
No.
At that point. I mean, didn't need that kind of help anyway.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I kept, all the way through rereading it this time, I kept seeing the new kind of classic shop that's up all over the country. They're all exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
And they all have those quilted, this is and that's everything, you know, and they're kitschy kind of country stuff. And all of that kitsch is trying to get back to this. And, you know, we're, as Americans, we're spending millions of dollars to try to get a sense of heritage, a sense of our background. Even in Chicago, there's a big Scandinavian area where they sell expensive Scandinavian stuff for people to have in their homes so that they can feel Scandinavian. And in Minnesota, where I grew up, in Moorhead, there's the same thing. There's Scandinavian shops all over the place. Expensive ones, mind you. And it isn't necessarily, I mean, I remember when my Grandma Bew made nissa, little nissa to hang on the Christmas trees, and she made the little black feet out of melted something that you formed the feet out of. And I said to Grandma, I was in high school, she gave each of us a couple. And I said, is this Norwegian? I mean, give me a break. Grandma Bew is Norwegian, you know. She made it by hand. Is it Norwegian or not? Well, was it made in Norway? No, it was made in Minnesota. Is it Norwegian or not? You know, it's I was stuck. I'm D in lots of ways. I mean, I think a lot of us have that sense of wanting to get back to our heritage and claim it and buy it if we can, you know, get it into our houses in a way that is... not really seeing to the heart of the matter. It's a stage, but it's not getting there.
Well, I think my parents didn't save anything and haven't felt any need to pass anything down to us. And when we ask about things, they said, oh, you wouldn't care. And it's real frustrating because there is literally nothing that we can tell our own kids about their family because our parents don't think it's particularly important.
They didn't want to be anything but American.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Mm-hmm. I think, too, another reason it was a triumphant decision on the part of the mother to go ahead and give the quilt not to be was because it was a real unconditional giving on her part then. She's not going to give it to the daughter that will do this with it. Mm-hmm. You know, she's going to give it to the daughter with no strings attached.
Yeah.
And, you know, even if they wear
That's an
out.
Interesting point. Good. We have to go. But thank you. This was a fun discussion. I learned a lot.
Thank you.